Accession number 8668, room number 4.
Jackie Mockridge, Reel 4.
Well, when I got a job with Imperial Tobacco, who run an airline for their executives, and they do it every day, and they were a very nice company to work for, but the pilot was flying with me that particular day. I don't think he was very happy about the fact that, that we were both equal rank, and they always flew two captains. Just an example of how they treat us. And it was my turn to fly, and we were coming in to land at Glasgow. And it was a terrible day, stormy and raining, and we had everything, severe turbulence. And I was doing an ILS landing, which is an instrument landing system on my instruments coming in onto the runway. It aligns you up with the runway. And it really needs concentration. And my aeroplane, I was having such difficulty keeping it on the line. It seemed to be all over the sky. And after I landed, and this pilot kept nattering to me all the time, you know, and I felt like telling him to shut up. I couldn't very well. Anyway, after we touched down, I sort of thought I'd never been so hot and really worn out. And he said to me, "Oh, well, I didn't think you were going to make it." So I said, "No, neither did I. I've never known such severe turbulence, you know, at any time." And so he said, "Oh, that was me. I was just testing you out." He said, "I was playing around with the trims of the aeroplane as you were coming in." And, of course, I being short, I always lean forward more. And he was messing around with the trims, which I couldn't see him touching, which are the rudder trim, the elevator trim, so that the whole aeroplane was sort of being shoved from one side to the other with these trims, and I was trying to correct and also trying to keep my instruments in line with the runway. Just an example. Anyway, that particular story was funny because I left after that. I couldn't take any more. And he hired another pilot, and within a week that other pilot was killed because they took off from Turnhouse Edinburgh Airport, and this was in a 125 jet, which they also flew for Imperial Tobacco. And as they took off, about 50 feet, he cut the one engine. The other pilot was killed because he wasn't expecting it, and the wingtip touched the runway, of course. And that's a thing. It's inexcusable because you're not high enough to cut an engine, and you've got full power on both. Suddenly, once cut, you just swing right into the, you know. So anyway, he was killed, and that was his second trip with the company. And that's the sort of thing he did. He was nasty. He wanted to catch people out all the time. Well, you see, it's not really a professional pilot that does that.
What about during the war? How did the male pilots work with you then?
Well, I didn't see a lot of them at the time. And they were very good usually, but they didn't like it when you got into an aerodrome in bad weather and they didn't make it. They went and landed somewhere else. They probably had wine or a drink with their lunch or something, and, you know, couldn't see straight or something, but they didn't like it. And that happened quite a lot. You know, you would land and then you'd find the other chap say, "Well, I couldn't land, the weather was much too bad, I had to go somewhere else," you know. And they said, "Well, Jackie got in, or Mary got in, or so-and-so got in, one of the women," and they didn't like it a bit, you know. They said, "Oh, well, of course, they probably shouldn't do that, it shouldn't be allowed, you know, they were probably dangerous and they'd kill themselves." They didn't like it. But then on the other hand, I think secretly they really admired us, quite honestly, because they knew what a hard job it was. And there's no doubt about it, unlike today's flying, it was a hard job because you had to do everything yourself and you had to see the ground, and if you lost it in cloud, you had great difficulty finding yourself without hitting a hill.
You went on conversion courses. Can you tell me a little bit about the training that you received?
Yes, well, after I'd been in the ATA about a year and a half, and I'd already flown Spitfires and single all the high fighters, fast fighters. But we were then going on to twin-engined aircraft. So they liked us to do a conversion course. So after a 3 weeks ground conversion course, learning about the engines, we were then instructed by by some of the, and the only one I can remember is Joan Hughes, because she instructed me for the twin-engined Oxford, and she gave me about an hour and a half on the twin-engined Oxford, and we did a few landings, and she's a very good instructor, you know, she makes you feel at home and comfortable, and then we did landings and takeoffs and that sort of thing, because that's obviously all we do, ferrying aeroplanes, and we found that then we were supposed to be able to fly everything after that, the Mosquito, which is very fast, the Boston, the I can't think of all the aeroplanes, the Marauders, the Albemarles, all the twin engine aircraft we were supposed to be able to fly after that. And then a little later on we went on another course, or I was sent on to Greenham Common, which was an American station then, an American Air Force station, and I flew on the Hudson, which was apparently supposed to be a very difficult aeroplane to fly, and they insisted we had an hour on that. Well, I did actually three landings on that, and he said to me, all right, you're fine, take it up yourself. And I was petrified, because it was very different, a cumbersome aeroplane, and you had to land, and when I put the brakes on, I couldn't see out, because you had to bend right down, and I being rather short, I couldn't see out. And I had to be brought forward about 12 inches to be able to reach everything. But he seemed to be happy with the three landings I did, and that's all I did, three landings, and then I was supposed to fly everything after that. But I did ferry a lot of those Hudsons afterwards. They were, a lot of people used to land, and after they'd land, they'd swing on their tails and end up in the opposite direction and do some damage, because they weren't easy to fly. I was lucky, I suppose. I still say because I was, I'd flown or learnt on Tiger Moths, which was the same idea as landing a Hudson. You know, it was very tricky. You had to be careful.
So you had about 1.5 hours in the air.
Yes.
Did you receive any ground instruction?
Yes, we did 3 weeks ground instruction, and that was to explain how the various... it wasn't too thorough, you know. It wasn't an engineering course as such. It was the sort of thing to show you why you have a Stromberg injection carburetor and that sort of thing, and how it works, and when you get to altitude to conserve fuel, how you conserve fuel by throttling back at altitude and that sort of thing, and there's no need to go at 400 miles an hour when you can do 250 and save half the fuel. And they trained us to do that sort of thing, you know, which was very helpful. And if your engine cuts, the first thing to look for, because sometimes it doesn't, you don't really notice it on your instruments, you just know that your aeroplane's going one way and the propeller's still going round, and then you have to learn to feather it and all that. That means stop the engine so that it's not swinging round and being an extra weight and it's facing into wind, static, you know what I mean? And that saves, and a lot of aeroplanes, of course, the Marauder? Well, something like that. That was a difficult aeroplane on one engine. They tried to tell you that and how to handle them. I did have one instance where the engine cut on one of those types that they say were impossible to fly on one engine. But I was only bringing it from Southampton to White Waltham, which wasn't very far. And I was at about 1,500 feet. And I just managed to keep it in so that I landed at White Waltham, struggling all the way, you know, across the runway, across wind, everywhere else, but got it down just because it was losing height all the way. It cut out at about Winchester. So I had from Winchester to White Waltham, which is near Maidenhead, to just about make the runway and just get out. And I was lucky, really.
Were you given any ideas as to what to do in such incidents?
Well, yes, that was the idea of the 3 weeks, you see, training course. That was really what they tried to tell us what to do. I mean, if there were instances, the most important thing was to get this very expensive aeroplane safely to its destination. So if you couldn't make one airport, for goodness sake, land anywhere that you think will land it safely. The most important thing was the safety of that expensive aeroplane. It didn't matter too much if you killed yourself, but it was important that you saved our valuable aircraft in the war, which we didn't have enough of.
How adequate was the training that you received?
Well, I thought it was very good because I'd been to an aeronautical college, remember, and I found at the aeronautical college they concentrate a lot on navigation and all that sort of thing, and you do the engineering as well, but of course it's not as high powered as this was, because we were flying sophisticated high powered aeroplanes, so you had to think very quickly, and it might be that the first time we'd ever flown that type of aeroplane, and you only had about half an hour or so to study it before you got in, so you didn't always have time enough to think about it.
What ferry pool were you based at?
15 Ferry Pool, Hamble, for most of the time, but I had a year at number 1 Ferry Pool, Hatfield. I think it's number 1, it's a bit vague. 15 was the women's pool at Hamble, so after a year we were posted to Hamble. We did about 4 years, well, I did 3.5 to 4 years there. And then I spent the last part after the war in peacetime when we were still ferrying and I was heavily pregnant with my daughter. I then spent that at Prestwick in Glasgow, near Glasgow, and I was flying there quite a lot of mostly naval aircraft.
How did you assess the all-women pool?
Well, I found them all very nice. They really got on. As long as we were left alone, we got on very well. People helped each other. One pilot, I won't mention names, who didn't like flying an aeroplane that they clamped, locked you in, you know, the ones that did high surveillance and photographic aeroplanes, and they were pressurized, they used to lock you in them so that you couldn't get out till you got the other end. You know, if anything went wrong, well. But some of them felt claustrophobic and they felt they couldn't do it, so then one of us would volunteer to do it for them, which, you know, was very sweet and kind. And another one would want to go and get married or go and see her parents or her daughter or whatever, and then people would volunteer to do their jobs for them. And, you know, everyone was very, very helpful. Personally, I found them very charming. And as I say, only one girl ever did I find. And I felt a bit sorry for her because I don't think she meant to be. She just didn't like women.
And were you billeted at Hamble?
Yes, we were all billeted with private people, except three girls who managed to hire a cottage and thought they would try to live in the cottage, which was very successful, and they got on very well with each other. And the people that we used to pay, don't laugh, we used to pay £2 a week for our boarding and lodging. Mind you, we weren't there all that much because we were all over the England and staying and coming back in trains and staying overnight at other places. But on the whole, they were very good to us. My first digs I had in Hamble weren't so good. She was an Indian warrant officer's wife or something, and she didn't like women either. And I don't think she realised what we were actually doing. She was army, and I don't think she understood the Air Force. And I was half starved there, I mean, really. And that was terrible. But later on, I went to stay with the Greenhills, right near the airport, and it was lovely. Get on my bicycle and cycle way round and not hold my hands the whole way from there till I got to the aerodrome. You know, I was young enough to think that was fun.
And you yourself were married?
No. Yes, I was, but I was married in January 1945. And that was just before war, well, June, what was that, about 5 months later, we had peace. But I went on ferrying, of course, because we had to clear the airports. And on the last day of, I don't know whether it's of interest, but Victory Day, I took off a mosquito, and my husband was then just stationed at Aldershot in the officers' mess there, Malta Barracks. And I took off at about, before the 1 o'clock news, about 1:45. And by the time I'd got over his Malta Barracks, I used to go and beat them up, you know, in a mosquito. And it's got a big globe around it, so you can see the pilot very clearly if they're low down. And I didn't have a helmet on or anything, of course. And they could see me and my hair blowing, not blowing, but, you know, they could see it was a woman. And I was beating up the mess. But what I didn't know was that at the 1 o'clock news, they'd heard that peace had been declared, or whatever you call it. And I hadn't heard that. And they thought I was beating them up because I'd heard of the news, you see. So they all came out, all the officers came out onto the lawn, and then I really went to town, you know, zoomed right a few feet above their heads and went all the way. And I was taking it to Ireland, actually, at Aldergrove. And my husband said afterwards, he didn't dare come out because he thought, they said, your wife's up there, you know, come on, come and see. But he wouldn't come out because he thought I might kill myself. And he stayed inside. However, when I landed at Aldergrove in Ireland, I was whipped out of the aeroplane by all the maintenance units people. We were taking it to a maintenance unit there. And flung me round. They all took it in turn. And they all hugged and kissed me. And I said, what's the matter? What's happening? You know, I thought they'd never seen a woman before or something. And they said, this is the last mosquito you'll be ferrying, I expect. The war peace has been declared, you know. And we're no longer at war. And they said, take anything you want to out of the aeroplane. And, of course, like a fool, I only took the cushion, and there it is by my fireplace. That's the cushion from the mosquito I was sitting on. And I didn't like to, if I'd had any sense, I'd have taken a compass or something you could have, you know.
What was the official attitude to beating up?
Well, I bought an old car for 30 shillings, and of course, I didn't know how to drive a car, but somebody showed me the knobs, as we call it, you know, so I just drove it for the first time in my life. And I drove it up to from Southampton to Aldershot and rang the bell in the mess. And as I walked through, the colonel was passing, and he said, because I was in uniform, you're the young lady that nearly took our chimneys off on Victory Day. And, of course, I apologised most profusely and said it wouldn't happen again. He said, well, he'd made allowances as it was Victory Day.
You say you ferried across to Ireland. Did you go across overseas often?
Well, Ireland, we didn't call it overseas. It was part of Britain, Northern Ireland.
I mean, actually flying across the sea.
The Irish Sea?
Yes.
Well, yes, we did, of course. I mean...
That was part of the job.
Part of the job, yes. Oh, yes, part of the job.
Yes. Were you given any instruction about... I know you'd done a parachute jump before.
Oh, we didn't have any inflatable dinghies or anything like that, you know.
You didn't?
No. If you went down, and not at that time.
Were you given any instruction on bailing out at all?
Yes, we were, actually, and I can't swim and never could swim. And one very cold November day, we were taken over to the Navy near Southampton. I think it was Gosport. And you had to use a swimming pool there, and we had a high diving board 15 feet above the pool, and we were in full equipment with our dinghies and our May Wests, as we called them in those days, which is a life jacket. And you had to stand on this 15 foot and jump in, and as you jumped you had to release your parachute and try to inflate your dinghy, and not your dinghy, sorry, your May West. And with all this you had your uniform on, plus some sort of overall. So you felt very encumbered. And I never had to be so brave in my whole life as I had to be that day to jump into water, which I'd never done in my whole life. Couldn't even swim. And then after you got into the water, you inflated your life jacket, which immediately pushed your feet right up, and you didn't know what to do. I didn't. And then you had to inflate the dinghy, and then get into the dinghy, and unless you did that, they said you weren't going to fly again, you know, not over water. I managed somehow, but it was a terrible struggle. And as I say, looking down at that water from 15 feet, I was terrified, because the water also was 15 feet deep, so that if I'd hadn't inflated my May West, I don't know. So I have no idea. I've never swum in my life.
But you were provided with a parachute, but not with a dinghy when you flew.
Yeah, oh, you're not with the dinghy, no. Yeah.
Can you remember what the pay was?
Yes, I got £6 a week in the beginning, and that was much less than the men received, which was £24 a month we received. And they did a big hoo-ha, I think, towards the end of the war, and I think they improved it then and paid us all a little more towards the end of the war. But I can't remember, but I do remember because... I can only remember that the £6 a week seemed absolutely, absolutely, well, a fortune compared with the 9 shillings a week I was getting in the Women's Royal Air Force.
Why were the rates of pay so much higher?
Well, we were doing quite a dangerous job, you know. Well, I suppose everybody was dangerous in war. I was in radar, I could have been bombed any time. I really don't know. I remember telling them when I first went into ATA, they said, what were you getting in the WAF? And I said, 18 shillings, but that's a fortnight, you see. So they said, oh, that's not bad. And then I realised she thought I meant a day.
And what about leave? What sort of leave did you get? Time off?
Well, you know, I can't remember a lot about that because I very seldom took a lot of leave. I think that's why I ferried so much more aeroplanes, because I used to take anyone who wanted leave, I would do their job for them rather than take the leave, because being living here and really not having relations of my own, I didn't have to go anywhere. So I'd rather flew, but I think they had a day off a week, I'm not sure. It depended, honestly, on how many aircraft were to be ferried. There was nothing about Saturday afternoons and Sundays or anything like that. Christmas Day you flew just the same. I remember being one day, Christmas Day, at somewhere like Landau or St Athan in Wales, you see, and spent Christmas Day with the mess with the men. That quite happened, you know, you landed there just before dark because it was your last job, and there's no way of being picked up until the next day, so you were lucky enough to have an RAF Christmas mess meal.
Were you ever able to go home back to South Africa?
Well, I managed to do that while the war was on, just before I got married, because I'd promised my mother I would, and that was a month before I got married, which was in the December, and it was about December the 12th, and I ferried an aeroplane to Lynham, and a Spitfire actually, and then when I got to Lynham I asked if there was any, I knew that they had aircraft going to Cairo, and I thought I somehow could hitch a lift, so I hitched a lift as supernumerary crew on can't think of the name now, great big American I can't think of the names, that's silly. Anyway, on a big twin engine or four engine, I can't remember now. And then when we got to Cairo, I then hitched with the South African Air Force on a supernumerary crew again on Dakotas, which were very, very slow. They did 3 hours flying, and then we stayed the 300 hours, and then we'd stay the night somewhere. So, you know, it took a long time to get to South Africa, about 5 or 6 days in this Dakota. And then I saw my mother there for three, and then I had to try and arrange a trip back. And I did it the same way coming back. But my difficulty was getting another aeroplane to get back from Cairo to England. And there were some people, army people, coming back from India. And I got in an old Dakota then again to come to England. I was very, very sick that day because I was having my monthly period, and I felt awfully sick, which I used to have. I mean, I've often ferried an aeroplane with a hot water bottle on my stomach because, you know, I was in such agony, but I wasn't going to miss out on my ferrying. And we just had sort of benches on each side, and you just sat up all the time on these benches upright. And I was not only feeling sick with my tummy, I was also feeling sick, you know, air sick. And I remember I must have fallen asleep on the shoulder of one of the army men, and I was marrying my husband within 3 days after I got back. And the day that he was coming to Taunton, that was, well, the day we landed in England, he said, one of the men in the officer's mess, the Bengal sappers and miners that were coming back from India, said to him, oh, I had a lovely trip back, he said. I had a very glamorous, don't laugh, ATA ferry pilot who was really hot stuff. She fell asleep on my shoulder, and my husband said, do you mind? You're speaking of the woman I'm marrying in 3 days' time.
What was the official attitude towards hitching lifts?
Well, as I was a pilot, I could always go supernumerary crew. That was really why I could do it. You know, I mean, after all.
Did many people take advantage of this to
travel
around?
Well, we had not. Yes, we did. If we could get a chance, we used. That's the way everybody did it. Even the Air Force themselves. I mean, they weren't even pilots. It's the only way you could travel around in wartime. You see, it was very difficult getting buses and taxis and trains and things like that. Almost impossible. You had to hitch a lift. In fact, the only way you ever went anywhere was hitching a lift, because sometimes a train would take about 18 or 19 hours to get from one place to the other because of bombings and one thing or other.
At some point as well, I believe the ATA stopped asking their ferry pilots to return by train.
That's right, because it took so long. Yes, it did. It took so long.
You were actually flying in the wartime. Did you ever encounter any German enemy aircraft?
Well, I didn't exactly encounter them that I could see, but I knew at once or twice they were overhead, because after I'd landed and they'd put the balloons up, they told me afterwards, they're sorry they had to do that, but there were enemy aircraft overhead, and didn't I see them? But I didn't, of course. But there was another time when I was flying an aeroplane. It was a fighter, and it was an American fighter, a Tempest, that's what it was called, and it could do 400 miles an hour, which was quite a lot in those days, and faster than the Spit, and much steadier, you know, heavier altogether. And I was flying to Manston to take this aeroplane, and I suddenly saw what looked like the most odd-looking aeroplane coming towards me. And it was only after it passed me I realized it was a flying bomb, because it had the smoke pouring out, well, you know, the flames pouring out of the back. So I turned round thinking I'd dive down and try and tip it, the wing, so that I could get it away from heading for London, you know. But of course I couldn't catch it. I couldn't catch it. It was much even faster than I was. And that was really, I'd have loved to have been able to do that, because it might have killed a lot of people. Of course I didn't know. I wouldn't have known.
At the end of the war, you said you were ferrying your last mosquito to Ireland. Was that the last plane?
Oh, no. We went on ferrying then until that end of the year. You see, this was from June, and we didn't stop till the end of the year. And just before Christmas, actually, sort of, I was demobbed. And I was pregnant then, of course, and had my baby on March the 21st the following year, and I didn't tell anybody, because, well, it didn't show, and I was young and didn't matter. And but I told one or two of the girls, and they were terribly sweet, and once or twice I had an aeroplane that needed very heavy handling, and somehow or other they said they would do it for me, because, you know, I might have a miscarriage. They were very sweet. And that was when I was stationed at Prestwick in Scotland.
What would the official attitude have been if they'd known you were pregnant?
Oh, they'd have thrown me out, of course, immediately. Mm. They didn't approve of that, naturally. But we were women, after all. Just like we had these pains once a month and felt depressed just before and all that sort of thing. And sometimes, probably now I realise, once or twice, one of the women who were older than I was might have been having the beginnings of the menopause, and, you know, felt they couldn't cope sometimes with some of the aeroplanes. And that's when we would step in, one of us or one of the younger ones, and help out. Because first and foremost, we really were ordinary women. We were mothers. One was a grandmother. One was older than my mother, you know. And some of us were just young girls, so we were just ordinary women. There was nothing tough or unnatural about us.
You carried on flying until the end of 1945.
Yes.
What were you delivering then?
We were delivering all the aeroplanes to clear all the factories, because naturally you don't suddenly just stop making aeroplanes. It would be chaotic, because people wouldn't be able to... What would they do with all those aeroplanes in the factories? Everybody would be out of work. So you cleared all the factories as quickly as you could and sent them all.